Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On a Friday in early July, here's where we are. It's the jobs report, where good news is good news for a change. It's Egypt and American aid. And it's 50, yes, 50, 50 dollar movie tickets from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizal. It is Friday today, the 5th of July. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. We're going to dig right in with those jobs numbers. 195,000 new ones added to the economy last month. The unemployment rate for June was stuck, though, at 7.6%. So here with the good, the bad, and the ugly of the last 5 days are Catherine Rampell. She is at the New York Times today. John Carney from CNBC and his blog NetNet is in our New York bureau. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, we are going to talk a little bit about the downsides of this jobs report in a minute with Mitchell Hartman. But at the most fundamental level, can we say that good news is good news this time? 195,000, that's nice, nifty and all that?
Yeah, the numbers were good. They came in above expectations. And the unemployment rate stayed flat. But that's actually kind of a good thing in that more people joined the labor force.
Yep.
As well as more people getting jobs.
Yep.
So, you know, generally speaking, this was a pretty positive report, I would say. We also had some upward revisions to the previous couple of months. So, you know, generally speaking, yeah, it's a pretty good report.
John, quickly, your gut, and then I want to talk about something else with you, sir.
I just wanted to say how awesome it is that to get good news and not have everybody panic that good news is bad news. Having good news be good news is a sign of a healthier economy.
Exactly. I think that's exactly right, which is why I started so excited. But, John, I would like to discuss with you, sir, the 10-year Treasury note on which interest rates are going, relatively speaking, bananas above 2.7% today, which is, you know, small in the scheme of things, but a big jump over the last month or so. Why are interest rates rising?
People believe that the end of the taper, as everybody calls it, the end of QE will eventually.
Well, hang on a minute. Let's get the nomenclature watch out here. Right, it's the Fed's program of buying bonds and boosting the economy.
Absolutely, and Ben Bernanke has signaled a timeline on which that program may end. People believe that program ending will eventually lead to the Fed raising rates. And so rates are going up ahead of that in sort of a forecast of those rates going up. And, you know, it's not clear that the market's right about that. We have Fed guys coming out saying, you know, just because we end quantitative easing doesn't mean we're going to come in and raise rates right away. But the market doesn't trust them, it seems.
Catherine Rampell, is the market an idiot? Right? I mean, come on. The Fed is saying, no, don't pay any attention to what the market's doing. And yet the market's going crazy. The bond market.
Well, I think the market is trying to read the tea leaves. You know, sort of classical economics would say that the market is the smartest guy in the room, and that, you know, and markets are supposed to be efficient, more or less. Larry Summers' rejoinder to that in a paper that he wrote a while back was, you know, that how can markets be so smart? There are idiots. Look around. the idea being that yes, people make mistakes in their trading. I don't know how to read the tea leaves here, whether that means the animal spirits of the markets or the Fed itself. You know, there are a lot of different comments coming from different members of the Fed that seem somewhat contradictory. So you can kind of read their feedback in a lot of different ways.
And the market does, it's hard for me to say. Yeah. All right. Fair enough.
Yes, exactly.
Catherine, I wanted to ask you something, actually, but that you blogged about at the Times today in the economics blog. This idea that to sequester has or has not had an impact on the jobs market. What's your sense?
It looks like it has. I mean, it hasn't derailed the recovery totally. A lot of the doomsday forecasts that we had heard a few months back have not materialized. But if you look at the federal government, there have been layoffs. I think we've lost something like 40,000 federal jobs over the last few months. We've had furloughs, and those show up in the numbers if you look at the number of federal workers who are working part-time but want to be working full-time. Those were about 150,000 in June versus something like, I think, 50,000 a year ago.
Yeah.
So it's showing up in the federal government payrolls. It's also showing up in the private sector in the industries that are very reliant on federal funds, like a lot of defense contractors.
Yeah.
And not all of those defense contractors are the ones who make, you know, guns and Navy ships and things like that. They're also like janitorial services that clean military bases.
Yeah. John, quickly on a related but different topic, what level do you suppose jobs has to get to, and quickly now if you would, what level does jobs have to get to before we stop obsessing about it in a, oh my gosh, the end of the world is nigh sense?
I think if we get reports like we got today and consistently get around 200,000 new jobs, then people will start to relax. Because that's basically the level you need in order to not have to get workers coming back into the workforce and not have unemployment increase. And that will steadily decrease. Eventually, that will decrease the unemployment rate. For a while, we're going to stay at around where we are because encouraged workers are going to
come back,
come back. And so we're going to see higher unemployment, even though we're adding more and more jobs.
All right. John Carney from CNBC and Catherine Rampell from The New York Times. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
All right, we'll see you. Have a good weekend. All right, let me sum up here, if I could. Today's jobs report was, honestly, okay. Hourly wages are up. Gains in a whole slew of different industries, healthcare, bars and restaurants, computer technicians as well. But in a job market, as Carney was talking about, that is still much more recovering than recovered, it's not all positives. To wit, a big spike in the number of people working part-time, people who say they want and need to be working full-time. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman headed out to an unemployment office in Portland, Oregon to get that part of the story for us.
And the very first guy I talked to told me this.
Well, I'm working part-time because I was working full-time and that job has ended.
LaCroix Johnson Whitecalf is 40 with three kids. He's worked full-time in warehousing and tech manufacturing. Now he's selling insurance part-time by phone at just above minimum wage.
Well, it's hard to find a single job at one place full-time, you know. 10 years ago, I could go out and get all kinds of jobs real easy. So things like that is what I'm looking for, where you can just stay on for 20 years and, you know, build your career.
In June, the number of people who wanted to work full-time but could only find part-time work jumped by more than 300,000. And the situation hasn't improved in the last 2 years. Carl Van Horn directs the Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers University.
It's certainly a phenomenon of the deep recession. We've had all these workers who are underemployed. And I think it also reflects employers' caution in hiring full-time workers. Or they may have found that they don't need a full-time worker and they're just being very careful.
Van Horn says part-timers increase workplace flexibility and save employers money. Generally, these workers get fewer benefits. That's especially true now, says economist Michael Strain at the American Enterprise Institute, because of changes under the new health care law.
Employers are not required to provide health insurance to part-time workers, only to full-time workers.
That requirement has been delayed 1 year by the Obama administration, but that won't necessarily encourage employers to change their tactics and bring more workers on full time. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Traders today were a little bit, yeah, we like the job numbers. Oh, no, we don't. Oh, yeah, we do. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In Egypt today, there were more protests, more violence, more chaos and confusion in the streets. 17 people have been reported killed there. In Washington, D.C., meanwhile, more studied ambiguity over whether or not to use the word coup. Most of the time, when an army starts doing what the Egyptian army has been doing, that's what it's called. But President Obama hasn't said it yet because, in this case, it's a $1.5 billion word. That's the amount of foreign aid we give to Egypt every year. And once what's happening there is officially called a coup, American law says we'd have to pull the plug on all that foreign aid, as Marketplace's David Weinberg explains.
Of the $1.5 billion the U.S. sends to Egypt, the vast majority is going to the military, $1.3 billion to be exact.
And the vast majority of that military aid is actually spent in the United States.
Isabel Coleman is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. She says that military aid primarily goes to pay for weapons and training, but it also gives the U.S. leverage. One way to use that leverage would be to call this a coup and say to the Egyptian military, when you complete a peaceful transition to a democratically elected government, then you can have your $1.3 billion back.
To not call it a military coup, I think, wastes an opportunity to force a more open, transparent, democratic process.
There's no doubt that the Egyptian military likes getting aid from the U.S., but international affairs professor Stephen Biddle thinks that $1.3 billion in aid may not be the Egyptian military's top priority.
The topmost item on their priority list is surely retaining the system of privilege and influence that these officers have enjoyed their entire military career and which was threatened by the Morsi government.
And there's a much larger problem facing the U.S. If the administration cuts off aid, it suddenly has a lot less influence in Egypt, a key ally in the region.
Hence, there's a lot of unwillingness to actually pull the trigger because the fear is that Egypt will then go its own way and the United States will have no say in what happens.
And the U.S. would very much like to have a say in what happens. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Shopping malls in this shopping-crazed country aren't doing as well as one might think. Something like a third of them are in serious trouble. Lots are flat-out shutting down, in part because we're shopping elsewhere. Elsewhere as in online. Dozens of what are called dead malls have been bulldozed, but others are searching for a second life even with one foot in the grave. Blake Farmer reports now from WPLN in Nashville, Tennessee.
Welcome to the retail wasteland that is Hickory Hollow Mall. Two stories and a million square feet surrounded by a sea of parking lots. Empty parking lots. About the only thing it's good for at the moment is a game of street hockey, but there are plans for a couple of indoor hockey rinks. The city has taken over the old JCPenney to build a library. Dillard's is a satellite campus for a community college.
You name it, people are coming up with a really wide range of uses to plug back into these facilities, but I really would not say that it's come down to a magic formula.
Ellen Dunham-Jones is a Georgia Tech professor who keeps track of hundreds of shopping centers around the country that are dead or dying. According to her database, roughly 40 have been scraped to the ground. 50 or so are giving it another shot. She says the key to success is making sure it looks and feels substantially different.
If people go and just sort of feel like, it's sort of the same old place, or it feels kind of creepy, it feels empty, that's not going to work very well.
Not too long ago, Nashville's Hickory Hollow was the place to be.
Describe what you're seeing right now.
It's pretty empty. I thought there'd be more to it, honestly.
Jade Bradshaw is a young mother who grew up spending her Friday nights here. The anchor stores are being converted to new attractions, but all the interior shops have been rebranded as a global mall to cater to the area's increasingly diverse population. Things have been so slow since the grand opening in May, tenants still haven't been charged rent. Aza Aribi from Egypt has a jewelry shop. If she did have to pay rent,
I will be closed after 1 week. I can't make it. Just I can make it.
As of late last year, the new landlords are a well-intentioned husband and wife from India who've never owned a mall. Dr. Rita Agarwal was just looking for space to open a small medical clinic. But when she talked to the corporate owners, they practically handed her most of the mall for $1 million. To put this in perspective, it sold for more than $100 million 15 years ago.
That was the whole point of buying it, is turning it around.
And you did it sort of reluctantly, right? I mean,
Everybody's scared. We're really simple people, let's put it this way.
Dr. Agarwal says the hockey rinks and library coming to the site in the next few years should be a shot in the arm.
Really, the community is building it. When a community builds something, it's theirs.
If dead malls like this one do pull off a resurrection, they'll prove some experts wrong. An executive with one of the country's largest mall owners told a trade publication recently, many need to be demolished. You can put up all the signs you want and charge as low rent as you want, he said. Sometimes a mall has just reached the end of its useful life. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
This beast of a boat, he called it his black pterodactyl, cost $40 million to build.
The very exclusive and very expensive America's Cup. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials rode an up and down day to settle way up today. 147 points, just shy of 1%, closed at 15,135, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ up a full percent, 35 points, 3479. The S&P 500 up 16 points, also 1%, 1631, the number you're looking for there. In 4 days of trading, the Dow rose 1.5%. The NASDAQ jumped 2.2%. The S&P 500 up 1.6%. As we mentioned up top in the wrap, bond prices tumbled today. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.73%. That's almost a two-year high. When interest rates rise like that, so do spirits of the big banks. Shares of J.P. Morgan Chase and Morgan Stanley both spiked more than 2% today. Bank of America, Citigroup, and Goldman Sachs gained 1.7% apiece. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The Federal Reserve releases its monthly consumer credit report for May. Put away that sunscreen, Senator Reid and McConnell. Members of Congress get back into the grind after their 4th of July recess. And just 1 year ago, the space shuttle Atlantis blasted off into space, marking the final mission of the shuttle program. I'm Denise Guerra.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Shares of Oracle were up almost 1.5% today. I mentioned that not for any tangible business or economic purpose, only to be able to note that Larry Ellison, the founder, CEO, and biggest shareholder in that company, is now even richer, which means he's got more money to pour into the America's Cup. One of the world's most famous yacht races officially started yesterday in San Francisco Bay. Ellison's pursuit and eventual winning of the Cup was decades in the making. It was realized only through a most unlikely partnership. Julian Guthrie tells that tale in her new book. It's called The Billionaire and the Mechanic. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me on. Very excited to be here.
I'm excited to talk to you because, A, I'm kind of a fan of the America's Cup, but that's a whole different story. But this is a crazy, crazy narrative you tell about Larry Ellison, bajillionaire, and Norbert Byron, a radiator repairman, winning the America's Cup. I mean, it's nuts.
Well, I'm glad you're a fan of the America's Cup, and it is kind of it's a story that doesn't come along very often, where you have this unlikely partnership between the billionaire and the mechanic, and both are very colorful characters, and I got to spend a lot of time with Larry and a lot of time with Norbert, who is the commodore of the Blue Collar Boating Club on the San Francisco waterfront that is now host to this elite nautical event.
It's funny because much like, and I hadn't actually thought of this until these words are coming out of my mouth, much like Larry Ellison pursued the America's Cup as a business operation. I mean, you know, you say that repeatedly in this book. So too did Norbert Byron think of this as a business proposition, right? He needed an investor basically in his club, and he said, here, let's see if this happens.
You know, Norbert is a business guy. He runs and operates a radiator repair shop and has done so very successfully through the ups and downs. And when he and Larry finally met, and Larry said to him, you know, you and I are not so different. You own a mechanic shop, a radiator shop, and I own a computer shop. And
Yeah.
You know, it's a little far-fetched.
No, I like that, though. I'll go with that.
It's a little, you know, a few zeros difference.
Once Larry Ellison sets his mind to winning the Cup back, God, it's 10 years ago now, right?
Yes.
How long does it take him and how much does he spend to do it?
Well, it took him a decade. Each time it cost him between $100 million and $200 million each campaign. Hmm. And in the last campaign in 2010, that was by far the costliest. This secret weapon, this beast of a boat, this he called it his black pterodactyl. Huh. And that was a boat that cost $40 million to build. But it had this wing sail, you know, that was 230 yeah. feet high. When you stand it up, too tall to fit under the Golden Gate Bridge. I mean, it was just a phenomenal wow. boat.
But that kind of goes to the criticism of what Ellison has done, and I know I'm blaming him, but it's a wider thing. That goes to the criticism that he's made it even more expensive, even more high-tech, taking some of the charm out of this 170-year-old competition by now.
Well, I think that they were trying to come up with a boat that would appeal to the major networks to get network coverage for the first time in the history of the Cup. To do that, he knows that you have to make it fast and you have to make these boats really stunning visually, and you have to make them big enough that they look really good on TV. And again, the speed, you know, it's turning it into Formula One or to NASCAR, where you have the speed, but you also have the potential for crashes. And I hate to say it, that's a part of the appeal of sports.
After the racing is done this summer and the Cup is won or lost by Larry Ellison and Norbert Byron, what are these two guys going to do? Is Larry going to keep it up? Is Norbert going to stay at the yacht club? What's going to happen?
I think that this is the end of the tenure of Norbert as Commodore. And I think that Larry, you know, if they win, he's going to either stay in San Francisco or look to another venue where it can be very commercially successful. Mm. But first, you know, they have to win it.
Julian Guthrie's book about Larry Ellison and the America's Cup is called The Billionaire and the Mechanic. Julian, thanks a bunch.
Thank you very much for having me on.
French lawmakers have their hands full. There are spats with Washington over the NSA spying scandal, all the Eurozone debt crisis stuff, and of course, food. Last week, the National Assembly in Paris voted to force restaurants to say right on their menus whether the food they serve is homemade, if you will, prepared on the premises. Because with a culinary reputation to defend, the French are worried that some restaurants in town do little more than serve meals they've bought from wholesalers, ready-made. John Lawrenson reports from Paris now on how a nation of gourmet chefs has been turning into a nation of heater-uppers.
What do you think of this this menu here, then?
At a traditional French bistro in a lovely old square, food critic Daniel Bernard's glasses gleam skeptically as he spots an offering called Onion Soup of the House.
The soup à l'oignon.
Soup à l'oignon. Which they actually call maison.
Called maison, and in France, maison doesn't mean anything regarding to the law. There is always a house where the dishes are cooked.
But it doesn't mean this house.
Another telltale sign of off-site preparation is a large number of dishes. If the menu's as long as your arm, says Monsieur Bernard, you can be pretty sure that blanquette de veau façon grand-mère, veal blanquette like grandma used to make it, was in fact made in a factory. The so-called chef, he reckons, has taken it out of the packaging, tossed it in the microwave, added freshly chopped parsley, and voila, a dish bought for $4, sold for $20.
Excuse me?
And will the restaurant owner own up?
Je suis pour le fait maison. Tout est fait maison. Le poisson, je n'ai rien de surgelé.
No way. Everything here is homemade, he says. That's what they always say, says Bernard. Even when you wave in their face the packaging of a factory-made tarte tatin that you pulled out of their dustbin that morning. Can we take a look in the kitchen? No, they're much too busy.
We have, as a starter of the day, we make a tartare of fresh tuna with some...
In another restaurant just down the road, owner Xavier Delamour is all too keen to show his kitchen, busy or not, and give me a taste of his cooking.
The coriander there is really fresh.
Okay.
A French Restaurant Owners Union says 31% of French restaurants serve food that is pre-cooked elsewhere. Denamour reckons the real figure is much higher. In any case, the public is being conned, he says. But I put to him, even if it's prepared off the premises, the food in your plate could be just as good.
Of course not. Why? Because they put some additive on it. Stabilizant, colorant, epaississant, you know, things that making growing the
thickener,
food.
Yeah.
Thickener. If you buy things in the supermarket, you can read what you have in it. As soon as you go in a restaurant, you can't read.
But if French lawmakers get their way, you'll be able to soon. If the French Senate approves the measure in September, restaurants like this one will be printing up new menus by fall, where a symbol by each dish will show whether it's homemade or not. It might be time for places serving grandma-style veal blanquette to bring a real grandma back into the kitchen. In Paris, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
Time was when you took a date to dinner and a movie, the dinner was the expensive part. But if you bought what's being called a mega ticket to see Brad Pitt in World War Z, you probably would have had to skip dinner. Sure, the $50 admission also got you a poster, 3D glasses, and yes, okay, popcorn. But still, Marketplace's Stan Alcorn looks at the rising cost of a night at the movies.
If you believe what George Lucas and Steven Spielberg said at a recent panel discussion, the $50 movie is just the beginning.
Going to the movies, it's going to cost you $50, maybe $100, maybe $150.
Like Broadway costs today.
Yeah, it's like Broadway or going to, a football game.
Those prices are still a ways off. Nationwide, the average movie ticket is just under $8. But at the nicest theaters in big cities, it's getting closer to $20. USC professor Marty Kaplan says theaters are raising prices to boost revenue at a time when audiences aren't growing.
They've used gimmicks like 3D and IMAX as one way to do it.
Some American theaters are also charging a premium for more comfortable seats. And in Canada, the Cineplex chain is offering a super ticket, according to spokesman Mike Langdon.
Super ticket is actually the first ever bundle offering.
Like the World War Z mega ticket, the super ticket bundle gets you a seat in the cinema and a download for an extra $20 Canadian. It's a hint of what USC's Marty Kaplan says the theaters are really afraid of, the internet.
They think that it cannibalizes their own revenue streams. And they're possibly right about that.
If studios let people stream movies on opening weekend, theaters will be under even greater financial pressure, and they may have to raise ticket prices even more. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which it's quite possible virtually all of American popular culture as seen on television in the past 40 years jumps the shark. Look it up if you don't know what that means. Anyway, on the website Business Insider today, we found a map of the most significant television shows ever set in each of the 50 states. California, for instance, Baywatch. Can't argue with that. Pennsylvania, The Office. New Jersey, no, not Jersey Shore. Get out of here. The Sopranos, of course. You can check the whole map on our website. It's marketplace.org. And with that, we are out of here. It's Marketplace from APM on a Friday. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. I'm Kaya Rizna. We'll see you back here on Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.